Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sama sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sama sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sama sambuddhassa. Buddhang dhammang sanghang namassami. Out in the field, there's I remember when we first came here, the field was still a playing field, and there were the pitches were still marked out for the games, and we had buildings to look after and getting used to Amaravati as it was then, getting used to being here. And there was planned an official opening on the in May of 85, and I was very involved with the office and the work and the running around, and could see an incredible amount of things that were important to do. And these romantics in the community, they thought what was important was to build a stupa. And I was one of the sort of the killjoys. I thought it was going to be a waste of time. You know, you've got to get the sewage to work, you've got to get the plumbing to work, you've got to get the insulation in, you've got to get the electricity paid for, you've got to get the... And so it went on. And the romantics, the spiritual people prevailed, and they built quite with quite a lot of effort and quite a lot of ingenuity, a structure out of plaster, plywood, motorway cones, cake tins, and bits and pieces. They built the center of the universe. As many of you know, the stupa is a pre-Buddhist symbol. When the center of the universe died, in the times when people were just affiliated to a village or a small area, they would often bury the person and build a mound over them. And that was the beginning of stupas. The idea of building a burial mound, somewhere to put somebody important, somebody around which the village life revolved. When I got to New Zealand as the abbot there in 93, 94, they wanted to build a stupa. The community, the lay community, wanted to build a stupa. New Zealand is an earthquake country. if you're going to build anything there, it's got to be really, really strong, because it could move. Again, I wondered whether this was important. And as part of that investigation, I went to Burma, went to Rangoon, Yangon, Myanmar, for a few days. over the ending of 1 year and the beginning of the next, I think it was 97, 98, just 7 days. And I thought, well, I'll try and see how a stupa is, what a stupa is. Because I still had not very much feel for stupas. So I went to the Shwedagon, which is probably the biggest stupa, given its site on the top of a hill. That the stupa itself is 100 meters tall, and there are 4 tons of gold at the top from Thailand, and then on top of that there's a whole structure, and then right at the top there's a crystal, big crystal. They got pictures of it, green big crystal. And that crystal's right at the top. When you got down, you've got the levels, the sort of what on our stupa were the cake tins. Up there, I don't think they're cake tins. I think they're much bigger things. And then down from that, you've got the gold, and then you've got the gold leaf, and it goes down. There are layers in that. Then there's a level of the Shwedagon, which in order to get up onto it, you have to be. You have to give up your identity to get onto that level, at least symbolically. You have to give up your identity card or your passport in order to get up there. You have to be male too, and then you can go up onto that level of the Shwedagon, which is the top level that the public are allowed access to. And there you can make dedications and stick a gold leaf on. But to get up there, you have to go through a checkpoint, and to actually get up there, you have to hand in your identity card if you come from Myanmar, or your passport if you come from somewhere else. You have to give up your identity to get up there. And then below that, you've got a whole level of shrines and statues and places to make offerings that actually back onto the structure that goes up for another 100 meters. And they all have different importance, different shrines for different days of the week. So if you were born on a Tuesday, you can go and make an offering to the Tuesday shrine, or whatever. And you've got these many, 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 many shrines, because it's quite. I suppose each side of the square base is maybe 70, 100 meters. It's quite a long way around. And this sense that all of this is important. All of these little shrines are important. And you can go, and you have to, or you can try and figure out which one's important for you, and make the right offerings there, and make the right pujas, or just sit quietly. And these are associated with maybe different villages in different parts of Myanmar, and different groups support them, and they have different things happening, and then you've got different times of the day, there'll be different people there. There's different nuns and monks will be meditating in different parts, and the lay people will be meditating. You know, people off making offerings, lighting lanterns, lighting candles, lighting oil lamps. Whole thing of activity happening. All these different things are important to all these people. And then there's a space that varies in width. I think it's got black and white tiles on, I can't remember. Black and white tiles. It's quite a big space. It varies, as I say, sometimes it's about 10 or 15 meters wide, sometimes it's a bit more, sometimes it's maybe a bit less. And this is the area for circumambulation, for walking around, for having conversations. Some people will be having conversations as they walk around. Some people will be walking very meditatively. Sometimes, like at the turn of the year, when they marked the importance of the turn of the year, the new year, around midnight on the turn of the year, the place was completely packed. You could hardly move around this area as you walked. Try to walk around mindfully. And then at night, if you're walking around at night, you have this, the thing is, the Shwedagon Gong is illuminated, it's all gold, so they like to make it shine at night, so they have these, they look like World War II searchlights. You know, the ones that you get with the Battle of Britain sort of looking thing. And they shine up at the top of the Shwedagon. And they shine up on this crystal. And of course the light is refracted, and if you walk around this area at night and you look up at the crystal, it doesn't look like very much most of the time. It just looks like a crystal right at the top there. But sometimes you can catch the light refracted through the crystal, and it'll be a blue ray that you catch, or a green ray that you catch. And you'll find these spots around the Shwedagon where a few people are going. And if you go there and you look up, you'll say, oh, the crystal's turned blue, and if you move a little bit. So, which is one of the fun things you can do around the Shwedagon. And you know, people are having conversations, meeting, chatting, or meditating. And the next sort of level on the outside of this walkway area, as I remember it, there are more salas, meditation places where you can have your fortune told by different people. You can people sitting, places where there are you can have something to drink sometimes, or people collecting money for this or that, or things happening. If you go up in the early morning, if you go up in the very, very early morning, before there's anybody there, you can go up there, you can walk around, and the whole place is empty and quiet. Get up there just before dawn. If you're dressed as a monk, you can usually get in, because this uniform is quite a good pass. But for most other people haven't arrived, and they've got the they have military guards on the thing, on the tops. So you can go up and then you can walk around and you can see the place is empty, or you can walk around later on and you can see the place is more full, and again you'll have salas dedicated to different meditation groups, different monasteries around the place. And there are four entrances to the Shwedagon, to this area, the area that you can walk around into the area, sorry, that's, which have staircases. Some of them have escalators, and there's one that has a lift actually, and some you can just walk up. And these areas leading up to the Shwedagon on each side of the stairways, there are shops selling different religious artifacts. I think each staircase probably has a speciality and different things happening. Robes for monks you can buy there, and books and Buddha rupas and different things. And there's the level down just off the top bit, and you can walk off that, and then you get a whole museum that explains how the Shwedagon was used and what it was, its whole history, what it was used for, how it was built, all the bits and pieces around it. And there's another level that you've got other small stupas and chedis with different importances and different symbolisms. And the rings, if you go down the rings around the Shwedagon, as you go down off this layer, you go down and do. And I really wanted to explore this. What is a stupa? Why is it important? So to go there every day and then explore and then see the sort of the back alleys and the areas just off the top, where you've got people making things for other stupas, and little factories. And then you've got meditation centers and people sitting meditation, and then you've got more happening at the different levels down, and people living there. And I think at one point there were people actually squatting there, and all different sort of illegal people, and you've got the trees. The trees start coming at the bottom levels of the hill. And you've got all of this, and this is the Shwedagon, the biggest stupa, the biggest chaiti. And still in Yangon, it's the tallest structure in Rangoon. They haven't built any skyscrapers that tower over it. So it looks important. It is important. And and then right at the bottom, sort of round the bottom, you've got a around in the area associated with it, you've got monasteries around the Shwedagon, and you've got streets with monasteries on either side where they have training monks, and the chanting comes out as you walk along in the morning, and they've got the speakers blaring out, and they've got the morning chanting coming out over the street, and you've got streets that sell Buddha rupas, or make the Buddha rupas that they sell, streets that have the robes and sort of stuff. And you've got at the bottom of the Shwedagon of the hill there, there's an army barracks. There's an army barracks. And all of it's important. The whole thing is important. The whole, all the different activities are important. The security provided by the army is important. One can see what happens when security breaks down, with the story of what's been happening in New Orleans and the Mississippi, and how for society, for that, you know, when that breaks down. And then all the different activities, the human activities up as one goes up, and the different things that are happening, all important. All important, all important to somebody. You know, and then one can think, well, what's important here now? And you know, the air is important, the water is important, the basic requisites are important. And a sense of, is there any limit to what's important? And yet there's something about that symbolism of the stupa that for me, you know, stopped all that. And that sense of, you know, that the clear, precious crystal right at the top, that's held right up there, and around which the whole thing revolves. All this activity, all these different levels, from this one goes down from that clear crystal around which the whole thing revolves. Because you go to the Shwedagon, it's just all the way around, there's always sort of some sort of movement, or something's happening, or something's, and yet there's something still and precious right at the top. What is that? That which can actually reflect, refract, notice. That which is actually still and precious. No, without, you know, that if a stupa is doing anything, it's asking, what's important right now? And that question, and what the heart does with that question, is what's important. Now that, being willing to ask that question right now, and notice what happens in the heart when one does ask that question, what is it that... And then how does the heart feel when that question's asked? What presence is brought when that question's asked? Because when that question is not asked, when that question is not asked, what happens? There's just a run and a habit, and the different things are important at different times and different. Well, there's no order. There's nothing still and precious at the top when that question is not actually asked in the moment. And in some respects, everything is important. All of it is important. Every single thing is important. Every single thing can have importance given to it. And then, and of course, that's saying at exactly the same time, absolutely nothing is important. Nothing is more important than anything else. And giving importance to one thing and not to another, saying that I want this and I don't want that, or this is important and that's not important. What's really important to you? I think, you know, I'm not going to tell you what's important. You know, it's something that you actually, I think the asking of the question is important. And the willingness to look at the space that comes when one does ask the question, what's important to me now? Where will I find that? Where I shall be completely fulfilled right now. Where will I find it? And having that willingness to ask that question. What happens? Yes, there are levels of importance. One can see that there's importance in basic physical security, not feeling threatened. There's a level of comfort that's necessary. The air is necessary, the water is necessary. The food and the basic necessities of life. And a sense of recognizing their importance. I'm not saying that everything is unimportant. I'm saying that everything has the same importance in its own way. And yet, what is it that stands above and beyond it all? Where does one find that? What is it around which everything revolves? What is it that gives the whole thing a center? A still center. And that's what the stupa asks one. So when we finally built that stupa with the cake tins and the traffic cone that I picked up that was dumped at the side of the road down at Little Gadsden, and we cut it so that it formed a bit something like a bit like a dunce's cap, and then we put the metal through that and put the cake tins on top of that. We painted it and put it together, and Ajahn Pasano was over, and there's a picture of him putting the whole thing together. And then so for the opening in 1985, we had the big opening time, and the nuns, the monks, and the lay people, and Tanjung Kumpanyananda. We had the whole thing, and then we could walk around in a stupa, walk around the stupa. Circumambulate. That act of circumambulation. You know, and when I went to Myanmar, I went every day for the 7 days that I was there. I went to the Shwe Digong at least once in the day, and often twice, and stayed for a number of hours. I used to walk there, or somehow get there. And circumambulate, walking meditation as one walks around, and just reflects, you know, what is it that I'm holding up around which everything else revolves? What is it that I'm holding up as important? Where is my refuge? Where is that which I'm holding higher than everything else? What is it? Who are my heroes? Is what I ask thee. Who are your heroes? That's the question I ask the school kids when they come. Who are your heroes? Who do you look to as important in your life? Who are the people you hold up around which you hold up as, you know, some of the people you hold up as somebody up there, around which things revolve, around which you measure things? Who are your heroes? For school kids, it's interesting to know they have posters up on their walls. This gives an idea of what one thinks of as important. What is it that around which your life revolves? Who are your heroes? For some people, and I can see that there's an importance in this, your family. It's a whole thing, the whole sense of your family. And then what importance do you give that? And how does that work for you? How safe are your heroes? How secure are your heroes? If one's giving importance to things, then just how important are they? What level of the stoop are you actually going to put them on? it's really the question. I think the whole of the Shwedagon is the stupa, from the base and the monastery and the whole city around it, going up through the barracks, through the different religious shops going either side, through the art, different places where they make artifacts and bits and pieces, and the different meditation centers and monasteries and things where you can go, and then the areas around with the meditation centers, and then the area where you actually make the circumambulations, and then the shrines attached to the back of the back onto the actual Shwedagon, and then the area where you give up your identity. And then all that gold and all the different levels going up, 4 tons of gold at the top, the levels, and the crystal. That's the whole stupa. And then the whole thing is, where do you put your levels of importance? If you are going to categorize your importance, and then how? And what's really important? I don't think that I can answer that question for you. But it's phrased as a question so that it's actually something that one can ask. Ask now. What's important now? And just how far from what you do consider important are you? Is it something that's immediate to you? Is it something that you can recognize here and now? Is it something that is present for you? What's important? Is it something that's attractive? Is it something that's inviting? Is it something that's leading to a sense of peace? Is it something that... For those of you who You know how I translate the Svākāto Bhagavata Dhammo Sanditiko Akaliko Ehipasiko Opanaiko Pachatang Veditabo Vinyuhi. Those are the description of the Dhamma, the description of the Dhamma in the Triple Gem. Now that which is well expounded by the Buddha, apparent here and now, outside of time, inviting or attractive, leading inwards to a sense of peace, realizable each wise person for themselves. And the Dhamma is an aspect of the Triple Gem, the three jewels. Do you put your jewels at the top of the stupa? What is it that, you know, and it's the, you know, what is it that's precious to you? What's important? Does Dhammang Saranang Gacchami, does that resonate for you? Is it somewhere that are you holding that as important? Are you remembering that that is important to you? Buddhang Saranang Gacchami, Dhammang Saranang Gacchami, Sanghang Saranang Gacchami. That sort of questioning. Who's your hero? And the kids come and say, "Who's your hero?" My heroes. The Buddha Gautama myself. He's my hero. The Lord Buddha. That reflection. And noticing, the sense of noticing what one can appreciate. The sense of joy that comes from appreciation, which is what's encouraged. Appreciating goodness. Where does one find joy in appreciating goodness? I think that that's what mudita is about, and I think that with the true like worship, a lot of the worship that we do, the chanting that we do, the reflective chanting that we do when we chant the morning or evening chanting, when we reflect on the qualities of the Triple Gem, it is the practice of mudita, or it can be the practice of mudita. A practice of conscious appreciation and the joy that comes from that appreciation of goodness. And dwelling in that. Sometimes I can remember thinking, I am never going to bow. I am not going to bow to graven images. Went for a few retreats like that. And then I remember when I actually asked Ajahn Sumedho actually to show me how to bow. I want to work out how this works. I am very interested in seeing what happens with this bowing business, because it's, you know, the way that I grew up, it was like, you do not bow, not to anything, anybody, at all, ever. Certainly not to graven images, and certainly not to people. And yet, there's something works with bowing. It's a, something happens, and I can now see the reason that for some teachers in the Tibetan tradition, they won't actually begin to accept somebody as a disciple unless they've done the fourfold preliminary practices. And the first of the fourfold preliminary practices is 100,000 prostrations. And their prostrations are not just our little tweeny bows. They're from standing upright to full flat. Flat, yeah. And you have to do 100,000 of those, and that's the first. Otherwise, you can't be a disciple of mine. And that, I can see that there's something quite precious about that within that tradition that could work. I've spoken to people who've done this. I've done quite a few of these. And the thing comes, they say that there's something about repeating this practice. Repeating, you know, because to do 100,000 prostration is a workout. If you really, really work at it, really, really work at it, you might get it done in 3 months if you do a few hours, 8 or 9 hours a day. You know, it's a lot. I've spoken to people who've done this, and you know, when there's the surrender and the bow becomes something that the whole being is doing, in the sense of what one's actually relinquishing, if one wants to say what's not important, what could be given up without any loss, to put that question the other way, self-concern, self-centeredness, conceit. That's the you'd lose nothing and gain everything that's important. We can give up our own ignorant self-concern. Be the kindest thing actually that one can do to oneself. Strangely enough. So I hope that gives some food for consideration, for reflection. Of course, it's not that important. You can leave it behind if it's caused any trouble or confusion in your heart. But if it is of some value, then please take it. And I do apologize if it's caused extra confusion.